Coming up after the news,
Philosophy Talk.
We want information. Information. Information.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Autonomy, the condition or quality of being self-governed.
Self-governed? We're governed by our genes, by culture, by education.
Can you really have free will when you're just the product of parents, mores, environment, and the like?
Autonomy, illusion or reality?
Autonomy with our guest John Christman from Penn State University.
Coming up after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Our topic today is autonomy. We're going to tackle this issue in several parts. First, we're going to ask, what is autonomy? What do we mean by autonomy? Then we'll ask, well, is autonomy really possible? And finally, we'll ask, if it is possible, is it a good thing? So, John, you're an expert at meaning. What do we mean by the concept of autonomy?
Well, autonomy is a word that we hear a lot in everyday life, but not quite in the way philosophers tend to use it. We hear about autonomous regions of Spain, for example, the Basque Country. Autonomous Quebec is an autonomous, semi-autonomous region of Canada. That means that these regions are allowed to make up their own laws to a greater extent than you might have expected. But when we talk about people, we have in mind, people often refer to Frank Sinatra's great song, I Did It My Way. People who make up their own rules, or at least decide on their own which rules to follow, which things are important to them, what their life's going to be like. That's an autonomous person, and a lot of philosophers think it's an important and an interesting virtue for people to have.
Yeah, making up your own rules, living by your own lights. You know, you could. It's important that you and I could live by the same set of rules, right? I could not cheat, not steal, respect others, and you could do the same. But I could do it non-autonomously because, I don't know, I'm just a conformist, or my parents told me, and I just gave in to what my parents said. And you're the autonomous person. You just gave yourself these rules and principles to live by.
Very, very perceptive of you, Ken. But, you know, you wonder whether really anyone is really autonomous. I mean, it's true, my folks were Republicans, and I've tended to be a Democrat. But is that because I just was autonomous or just reactive? So given the influence of genes and mores and peer pressure and culture, are we really autonomous? That's what philosophers tend to worry about.
A lot of philosophers do worry about that. I mean, you can take a lot of examples of people who aren't autonomous, like drug addicts, right? They think they have this overwhelming desire for the drug, and maybe they're deluded in thinking that they choose the drug, but actually it's the drug kind of controlling and not themselves controlling. And your example, your reactive example, teenagers often think that, you know, in rejecting their parents' mores and values, they're governing themselves. But you look at them more closely, and really what they're doing is being governed by their peers. So you're right. Maybe there aren't any autonomous people there. We have this illusion of autonomy, but maybe
well,
not.
Well, you know, it's often in philosophy we get this kind of situation. You take a word like free, and on the one hand you have arguments that no one is really free because of determinism and past circumstances and so forth. And yet, on the other hand, we make a distinction that's perfectly plausible, and similarly with autonomy. I mean, maybe nobody's completely self-governing, but certainly there's a contrast between the drug addict or the person who's just following out the life plan their parents charted for them, and a lot of people we see who we really would say, like Frank Sinatra, they're doing it their own way.
Right, and there certainly are people like that who seem to us to be doing it their own way, and our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, found such a person. She files this report.
If you could be really autonomous and blaze your own trail, maybe you'd sail around the world or become an archaeologist. Paul Skakowsky was a top physicist at the Lawrence Livermore Lab.
It was a very interesting environment. I mean, we worked with always with the latest tools, and we were doing cutting-edge work. It was the most powerful laser. We had the most powerful computers in the world.
He gave it all up to follow his muse and become a philosopher.
My main research now is in philosophy of mind and cognitive science. So I'm very interested in how, well, what the mind is. And I'm particularly interested in what neuroscientists can tell us about the brain and how the brain achieves cognition, and also the relationship of the brain to the mind and to consciousness.
Skakowsky left his job as director of the Institute for Scientific Computing Research at Lawrence Livermore. He pursued philosophy at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford before taking a year off to make some decisions.
It was an opportunity for me to finally do something in an unrestricted way for the first time, really, in my life. So I was doing interesting physics at the lab, no question. But I think that my real passion was in philosophy.
Skakowsky stays in touch with his colleagues at Lawrence Livermore. What do they think of him leaving to pursue philosophy?
I guess that they do scratch their heads a bit. Many of them are pretty practical, scientific types. Philosophers are sort of unique in that respect. A lot of people think that we're odd, and I think that they're probably correct.
Philosophy's probably not what Skakowsky's father would have chosen for him. In fact, physics wasn't either.
Well, my father was a physicist, and he told me not to go into physics because I'd never make any money. And he advised me to be a lawyer. So I guess I disappointed him by going and studying physics and philosophy, which are probably the two hardest disciplines to actually get work in once you finish, and I put them both together.
Well, Skakowsky teaches philosophy at both UC Berkeley and at Stanford. He jokes that the decisions he made helped him discover the meaning of life. In fact, there's a link to it on his website.
My meaning of life link goes to a picture of a Little League baseball team that I was a coach on a couple of years ago. And they ended up having an undefeated season. The year before, they only won one game. So, you know, you only get one chance perhaps in your life, if you're lucky enough, to ever be undefeated. These kids will never have another season like that. And they probably won't even remember this one. But the coaches remember it, and we had a lot of fun. For me, if there is a meaning of life, it's the smiles on those kids' faces.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
That was Polly Stryker and Paul Skakowsky, a former physicist, now a philosopher who finds the meaning of life in children happily playing baseball. Not a bad way to achieve autonomy, I guess. Making up your own rules when you play baseball, maybe. That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by John Christman. He's professor of philosophy and political science from Penn State University. He's co-editor of Autonomy and the Challenges to Liberalism. John, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken. It's nice to be here.
John, compared to individualism and freedom and free will, autonomy may be a word that we don't hear too much about in ordinary life, but it's part of the same family for philosophers. Could you orient us a little and briefly to these different concepts and where autonomy fits in this galaxy?
Sure. As you were saying in your introductory conversation, autonomy means basically self-government. It comes from the Greek root autonomos, which means being a law unto yourself, and it had originally a political meaning. Contrasting the Greek city-states, which ruled themselves, as opposed to the ones which are dominated by others. And it can be distinguished from those other concepts you mentioned, for example, freedom, from in that freedom in its dominant uses refers to action and what is either allowing us to act or stopping us from acting, where autonomy will concern the internal conditions of the motivations and values that move people to action. So it has to do with how you come upon the desire or motive or value that moves you to act. And an autonomous person does this in some way, which is reveals self-government, which is independent and competent and reflects the fact that they're their own person, where the heteronomous person, the person who lacks autonomy, is somehow manipulated or brainwashed or coerced. Or
John, let's untangle this a little bit. This is you said a lot there. I mean, freedom. So yeah. You know, so it sounds like there's a kind of notion of freedom that I'm free if, say, I can do what I want to do. I want to do something, and I can do it. So I'm free to do it. There's a kind of freedom of action there or something. And autonomy, see if I've got this right from what you said. Autonomy is more about something about where am I wanting to do it or choosing to do it comes from. Right, and it's got to be somehow totally self-given or something like that?
Well, that's one is invited to say that it sounds like it has to be totally self-created. But I would like to make a very important distinction between self-government and self-creation, because the tradition of philosophy and political thought that values autonomy has sometimes been charged, and perhaps rightly, with thinking that autonomy means making things up yourself. Making up your own rules, as John said at one point. Well, that's a natural way to think of it, but if that's what it means, then it's very unclear why it's a value, or even if it's possible, as you all suggested. It has to be something about reflectively taking up those motives and values that we find ourselves with. So it may not be self-creation, but it might be something like self-management, the ability to reflectively follow the wants we find ourselves with and pursue them and develop them, as opposed to just being a passive kind of a cog in some other bigger wheel.
So that's the idea. Let me take an example and follow it through and see if I've got these distinctions. So here's a fellow. He's sitting there, and he's going through a cafeteria line, and he's got a choice between a big plate of broccoli and a big plate of chicken and a big plate of meat. And he's free. Nobody's coercing him to take one or the other. But the first fellow, we'll suppose, takes the meat because his parents took meat, then everybody takes meat, and why shouldn't he take meat? He never gave it a thought. The second fellow's a vegetarian, and he's not a vegetarian because his parents were vegetarians, but he thought it through at one point and decided, well, you know, meat is too costly to the biosphere to produce nutrition. And besides, we're not very nice to animals. I'm going to be a vegetarian. Now, he is what you'd call autonomous. And yet, the vegetarianism was an idea that was around. I mean, his peers discussed it, so he's not quite what you'd call self-creating. Is that basically the idea?
That is the idea. And we do want to distinguish types of people of the sort you just described. But we don't want to create a concept that is so rarefied and ideal that no one ever exhibits it, and even if they did, it would be unclear that it would be valuable. So even the vegetarian came upon these values in some ways at moments in his life that were passive, that he was passive to. It just, you know, he had happened to read a certain book or someone talked to him a certain way. But what makes him autonomous, if he is his ability to reflectively endorse or identify with that set of desires, that it, the reflective capacity to say, you know what, I did get this idea from who knows where, but it's a good idea. Or I like, I'm speaking loosely now, I like being guided by this, and I'm going to continue to be guided by that.
John,
I'm
not sure if that's what autonomy is, how very deep it goes or how very important. That sounds like a kind of thoughtfulness or something like that. I want to ask our listeners what they think about the notion of autonomy. Are we self-created, or is that just an illusion? But can we have some notion of autonomy that's a little less than kind of full self-creation? Because, John, I really think what you're talking about is kind of thoughtfulness, you know? Reflect a bit, consider your different options. But if your thoughtfulness is itself just determined by a bunch of other things, I don't really know what it amounts to.
Well, philosophers have wrestled with this, as you can imagine, and they have talked about what they is sometimes called the regress problem, and it's that the conditions that people set out in their theories of autonomy, we'll talk about those conditions of what you're calling thoughtfulness, that we reflectively either identify with or reject some first-order value or desire. But then people ask, well, what about that thoughtfulness? What about that second-order motive? Where did that come from? And do we just have the same problem once again? That's, you know, what about our thoughtfulness toward that second-order thoughtfulness? Do we have to find a condition there, and does it move it back one more step? So theorists of autonomy owe us an answer to the question you're raising.
Yeah,
is
Jeff,
there really?
We're going to untangle a lot of what you said. First order, second order, that's all complicated stuff. And
right.
We'll untangle some of that after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is autonomy. Our guest is John Christman from Penn State University.
Is autonomy the fabric of a free society? Do we really want people who do things their own way? or maybe it's an overrated virtue left over from the Wild West. What do you think? Call us toll-free, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Autonomy and the Wild West, plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The subject is autonomy. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Think of children. We think autonomy is a great value, but do you think it's really important to educate children to be autonomous, or is it more important to educate them to conformity? I know that's kind of a loaded question, but why should we value autonomy in mere children, for example?
Yeah, probably the ones who've been parents will value it less than the ones who are still idealistically looking forward to it. The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is John Christman from Penn State University. John, you were talking about some complicated things. First order, second order, reflective endorsement. I want to take you through that a little bit more slowly. Okay, so take our vegetarian. I want to eat vegetables and not meat. That's a, let's call it a first order desire. I desire vegetables. But then the reflectiveness comes in, the second order reflection. Should I? Is that desire a good desire for me to have? Do I endorse my having that desire? Do I approve of my having that desire? Now, you seem to think that autonomy consists in my being able to stand up and look at my desires and first order motivations and approve them or disapprove them, and there, and somehow approving them or disapproving them makes them my own. Is that kind of the picture? Is that
that's the basic idea? That's the basic idea. And but what we have to add is some kind of condition on that reflectiveness, so that we're not left with asking that further question once again: where did that disposition toward reflectiveness come from?
Right.
And then,
because somebody could just have brainwashed you to approve of the vegetarian desire, right?
Right. So we have to have an account of what is competent reflectiveness, what is a non-brainwashed, non-hypnotized, non-pathological, normal person just thinking and reflecting. And philosophers will owe you an account of that, and saying if they're reflecting in that way and they endorse their first order desires or identify with them and or the like, then they're autonomous. And notice I can say all that about someone who actually conforms to social expectations, who's a go-along kind of guy or gal. It's not only the person who bucks the trend that's who's autonomous. I can decide that, you know, after having thought about it, I think going along with what the dominant style is in my society is the best way to go. And that's an autonomous decision in principle.
Well, there seems to be a question here between kind of the procedure and the substance. I mean, if I follow the right procedures, I think it over, I wonder what kind of person I want to be, and I decide, well, I just want to be a go-along and get-along kind of person who really doesn't think much about anything, like the guy in the line in Woody Allen's Manhattan for the theater. I mean, so am I autonomous because I followed the right procedure, or am I, whatever your other word was, heteronomous?
Heteronomous.
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 Not autonomous is the way I'll put it.
That's the easier way.
Because I end up in a situation in which I just do whatever my peers do. What is it, procedure or substance is it at issue here?
Well, we're getting to one of the many deep disagreements among philosophers about how to account for autonomy and what its value is. I think that the only way to really capture something that is valuable broadly and also does some of the other work that we want the concept to do is to defend a proceduralist account. The proceduralist account tries to be value neutral. It tries to say, whatever your values are, you're autonomous if you came upon them or reflected upon them in the right way. But there are many philosophers out there that think autonomy must be more substantive. They think autonomy means not having certain desires and not others, having certain values and not others.
John, we're going to have to explore kind of what that more substantive notion of autonomy consists in a little bit more, because I want to start asking you about the connection between autonomy and morality, but I also want to let some callers in here. 1-800-525-9917. We're talking about autonomy, and we have Spencer in Richmond, California on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Spencer.
Hi. I have a question about free will. It seems to me that it's not clear what the relationship is between autonomy and free will. If a mental process such as reflection is caused by the physical part of your body, then it seems to me that you should be asking the question is whether or not we have free will, whether or not that reflection is completely caused by the prior state that you have no control over. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Spencer, it actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, there is some kind of overlap between the notion of free will and the notion of autonomy, John Crisman. And can you disentangle that briefly for us?
I can try, but the caller is certainly correct to notice this overlap. The reflections on free will have always worried about the observation that we seem to be, we're physical mechanisms for the most part, and we seem to be caused in all our reflections and all our actions by physical processes. So how can it be that we are free when we're so caused? And theorists of autonomy also worry about that, but they try not to get entangled into that causal story at that very low level, the neurophysiological level or the level of brain processes. They worry more about cultural influences and parental upbringing influences or education and the things that we can do something about either from a moral point of view or socially, but ask very much the same question. Are those processes so fixed and so causally determined that there's no sense to be made of our being our own person or being self-governing?
Well, I mean, you could think, I think the question of whether it's all physical processes can be a real red herring. I mean, suppose I'm an artificial intelligence kind of guy and I'm designing a robot, a very intelligent robot. Still, I could come to a choice point. I want this robot to, say, be a bartender, to mix drinks. Right, but what kind of bartender? The kind of bartender that goes for the 4-to-1 martini according to the rule books, or the kind of bartender that experiments with a 6-to-1 martini? Then I could program into the robot this adventuresomeness. Look for your own principles. Read some books. Go to the internet. Come up with your own drinks. Or I could program into the robot being very rigid and doing things the way you were taught. So there's a contrast there that can exist even if we assume everything is physical and caused
right.
by antecedent
right.
conditions.
John, I think you're right. I want to switch the topic a little bit. I want to talk about autonomy and morality and politics a little bit, because it's like autonomy seems like a morally significant thing. It's good to be autonomous, right? It's good to be self-governed, and it's bad to have somebody else governing you. But wait a minute. Imagine a self-governing Satan. I'm going to do all these evil things. I'm going to do it of my own will and of my own choice, and I'm not determined by other forces. Well, bully for you, self-governed Satan. We still think we ought to do something bad to him, right? I mean, so what's the sort of moral point of autonomy?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I think that there are two ways to approach it. One is to the way Immanuel Kant did, famous 18th century philosopher, who said the capacity to impose upon ourselves moral principles, that the ability to say we are going to impose ourselves the law, that's the seat of all moral responsibility and all moral obligation. If we don't have that, we're not obligated to do anything. So that's one approach. The other approach is really from the observer point of view. When we interact with other people, and for example, let's say you're talking to a friend and they've had a few drinks and you're trying to talk to them and they're starting to show signs of drunkenness, you might ask yourself, are they over the line so that they're not really controlling themselves? They're really kind of getting tipsy here, and now I'm going to treat them paternalistically or condescendingly, or I'm going to try and get out of the conversation. Your question you're asking is whether they are autonomous in this particular local situation, and if they are, if they haven't crossed the line, you owe them a certain respect, and that's the other approach to autonomy from the point of view of morality. It's the seat of interpersonal respect that we seem to owe other people, at least when they're not drunk.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking to John Crisman about autonomy. I've got an interesting email I'm going to read here from Paul in San Francisco. Today, especially in the Bay Area, one often sees graffiti of a capital letter A with a circle around it, the anarchy symbol. Could you discuss the difference between anarchism on the one hand, on autonomy and heteronomy on the other? Anarchists, just misguided autonomous. What about that,
John? John Crisman. That's a question for you, because I don't know the answer to it.
I'll give it a shot. There is a school of thought. In fact, there's a very famous book, In Defense of Anarchism, by a philosopher we know, Robert Paul Wolff, who argued that if you value autonomy, then you really can't see any government as legitimate, because nothing except direct democracy on every issue, do people really get to choose for themselves what laws to follow? Now, it was pointed out, though it was an ingenious argument, it had such a strong, the conditions for autonomy were so strong, it was unclear that that was a value that people generally had. And so the relationship between individual and autonomy and, say, anarchism or political obligation will very much depend on what we mean by autonomy. And if all we mean by autonomy is the ability to follow rules that you think are legitimate, that you, again, may not have created yourselves, you might have not have voted on that particular issue, but you can go along with it, that means that political authority is compatible with autonomy as long as there are some checks and balances and you can say something through your representatives or other mechanisms to do something about those rules and therefore live in a government. So autonomy need not imply anarchism.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about autonomy. Now we're talking about the political and moral functioning of autonomy. And we'd like to know what you think. Should a just political system say respect the autonomy of all? Give us a call. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can send us an email, comments@philosophytalk.org. So I want to go back to this. We've said a lot here. I want to just go a little more slowly, and because on the one hand, there's this Kantian idea that the laws of morality are somehow expressions of our kind of mutual autonomy or something like that, right? I mean, you're not living an autonomous life unless you're living by autonomy, and that's somehow because we kind of give these laws to ourselves or something like that. And then you said something about the obligation to respect the autonomous decisions of others. But I really want to know where that comes from, the obligation, because you didn't address my thing about the autonomous self-governing Satan, a satanic figure. Could a satanic figure, right, who gives himself the law, screw everybody, use everybody as a tool? Now, why should we respect his autonomous decision?
Yeah, I craftily avoided that because it's a hard question.
That's the only kind I asked, John.
Right, thanks. Well, we have to ask about your autonomous Satan, and we have to make a distinction. We have lots of real Satans, as you know, and they're in jails, and we have to deal with them, as bad as they are, still with a certain degree. We put limits on the way we can deal with them, at least in most societies. And those societies are ones where we think, even if you've done the most heinous thing, you're the most horrible person alive, we can't just treat you like dirt. We can't just treat you like an instrument of our purposes. What we have to do is go through certain procedures, and we have to show a basic respect, even in dealing with your evil. Now, there's another kind of Satan, and this is one that Kant himself dealt with and had a lot of trouble with. And that's someone who loves evil so much that they really embrace the evil principles. It's not just that they know what's right and they've screwed up or they've done wrong. They really love evil. And that may be the kind of person that's beyond the moral pale. It's very unclear what kind of respect we owe that person.
Right. So, but, I mean, Kant thought that evil, that kind of person, the person who knows the right and embraces the bad, right? So that person's just incoherent, irrational somehow, right? Isn't that right? I mean, Kant seemed to think that if you were fully rational, you would embrace the moral law and you would be autonomous, that autonomy and rationality, full rationality and morality, somehow go together. That seems to me actually a crazy view.
It is. It could be a crazy view. Kant wrestled with its implications a lot. I think he owes us an explanation of how autonomy, we can be morally autonomous but then do wrong. And I think the distinction he tried to work with is the difference between a capacity for autonomy and the exercise of it. So if you have the capacity for autonomy, you know what's right, you can grasp the moral law. But in an individual instance, you buck that trend, you don't do that, and therefore you're held responsible for it.
1-800-525-9917. Join in on this conversation. So look, I'm wondering, suppose I could have a society filled with conformists who did the right thing, on the hand, or a society filled with autonomous people who, you know, sometimes did the right thing, sometimes not, but they were all autonomous. Why wouldn't I prefer the conformist who always did the right thing?
Got an email from Akiko in San Francisco. Dear philosophers, I come from a society, Japan, that values conformity. But now I live in America where individuality is supposed to be the greatest thing. The two moralities seem to totally contradict. Is there a right answer? How do I decide what's best for me? Sincerely, Akiko.
So she's asking a question somewhat like mine. What do you think, John?
Well, it's, again, an excellent question. I think the in thinking about autonomy, and especially in the political philosophy dealing with autonomy, there's a kind of fork in the road, and we've just hit it. And one says, well, autonomy is one of those, it's a parochial value. It's a value of some societies, but not others. And the democracies of the West, maybe the U.S. in particular, seems to value it more. Democracies in other places, or societies in other places, perhaps East Asia, value it less. That's one way to look at it. It's a parochial value. Not everybody has it. But then there's the other road, which is harder to follow, and that is, no, by autonomy, let's really massage the concept and try to talk about what everybody, even our friends in Japan, have. That is, they have a basic capacity to understand what they're doing, to either reject it or endorse it, even if what they do when they reject it or endorse it, and let's say endorse it, what they're doing is going along with a very communitarian, very connected, very embedded way of life. That's autonomous because the person can reflectively accept where they are in that very connected, very embedded
society. I guess you, if you were desperate to save the notion of autonomy, but there are critiques of autonomy that do say, and it seems to me they're important critiques. So, for example, feminist critique goes back to John's Wild West metaphor. A lot of feminists think autonomy is this macho male Western thing, right? Self-government, because it sort of glorifies non-connectedness, non-embeddedness in a community to which you kind of...
Clint Eastwood in all of this. Yeah,
so, I mean, you're trying to save autonomy from that critique, but isn't that just a kind of desperate maneuver, this kind of...
It could be, but I think that autonomy, even in this broad sense that I'm trying to wave my hand at, is something that we want to hold on to if we believe in certain related ideas like democracy. So, for example, that one of the reasons we, I think, would be against an authoritarian society, a dictatorship, there'll be several reasons, but one of them I think we won't be able to give up is the idea that we don't know really what's best for everyone unless we consult everyone. We don't have this preordained idea of what is ought to be chosen, what is always right or always wrong. We have to consult each other, and that's what democracy does. And unless everybody's autonomous in some way when they participate in that democracy, then it's unclear why we value that procedure.
We'll take this kind of question up some more, John, after our next break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing autonomy with John Christman from Penn State University.
We've talked a lot about personal autonomy, and we've gotten into society, and we're looking at the question, is an ideal society a collection of autonomous individuals? That's kind of John Locke's picture. Or is it a group of people whose autonomy lies in the fact that they jointly determine the rules for all? That's more the Rousseauian picture. We'll continue after the break.
The Locke versus Rousseau smackdown on autonomy, plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about autonomy. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry, And Philosophy Talk is a program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is John Christman from Penn State University. We want to know in this segment, is autonomy really a good thing? We've got a caller on the line, Ed in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Can make this simple. Suppose I have a decision to make whether I'm going to go to the trouble of making a decision or just ignore that and just go with flow. Once I've made that decision, though, whether it's free or not, I don't know, then suppose I'm in a situation where I determine what I desire to be nice to my neighbor and what I think I ought to do to be nice to my neighbor. There's no reason for me not to be nice to my neighbor, but I decide not to be nice to my neighbor. Okay, so then I would say I'm autonomous, but it seems to me like the only reason that I would decide not to be nice to my neighbor is because of unconscious forces, which means I'm not autonomous, or out of a perversity of doing the experiment of trying to be free, which is a reason.
Well, Ed, that's an interesting example, and I think it gets at the kind of complexity that always besets philosophers when they think about this galaxy of issues: freedom, individualism, autonomy, and so forth. you look at someone and they want to be nice to their neighbor and they think they should be nice to their neighbor, and then they're not nice to the neighbor. Is that being free because they weren't determined by pre-existing facts about their mind? But it sounds like it's not being free. It sounds like it's being stupid and irrational.
Yeah.
And yet we do have this intuition that somehow when we are truly free, we do act in a way that isn't bound or determined by our pre-existing conditions, even our mental conditions.
Yeah.
So there's a real complex of issues here that in any individual case can be quite a mess.
You're right, John. And some philosophers call this phenomenon, sometimes they call it weakness of the will, right? This is the good. I judge it to be the good. I want to do it, but I can't bring myself to do it. But if you look at it from an existentialist framework, you can see that as a kind of self-determination, right? Even morality can't determine what I will do, because I can say, well, that's the morally right thing to do, but you know what? I'm going to do something else.
We've got some email from John in Berkeley that gets us back to the topic we were discussing before the break. He says it seems like the concept of autonomy needs to be so deflated that it really doesn't matter that much. If democracy needs autonomous members, I suppose ones that can vote in their own interests, how does autonomy differ from desire? Why is it useful as something distinct from freedom, reflection, desire, and the like?
John Chrisman, excellent question for you.
Well, it is a good question, and I think that the answer, the road to an answer, is something along these lines. When we're talking about autonomy, we're not just talking about having a desire. Remember, we're talking about something like reflective desire, a kind of desire that you can see the point of, you can see the reasons for. And now getting back to democracy. In democracy, we don't just take votes. We discuss things. And some of us really like the model of deliberative democracy even better, where people have to get together and listen to other people's ideas. So if democracy doesn't mean just merely expressing desires, but doing so reflectively and doing so in a way that you can get behind, then autonomy is exactly what we want people to have the capacity for, because that's reflected in those political decisions. If we didn't have that, then we would just have, we would just be able to make up the most ideal society and then force people to conform to it. But we think they ought to have something to do, to say in that process.
Well, to cut to the chase, I mean, it seems like we might say, look, what we really want in a democratic society is autonomous thinkers that are not bound by conventional wisdom or what they're told to say. I mean, when we have town meeting, we want everybody to say what they think and what principles we think we ought to follow. But once we vote and decide the way the town is going to go, then, short of civil disobedience, everybody ought to get behind and allow those rules to govern their action. Is that the picture?
But I want to slow down a little bit, because I think autonomy is a fancy word for a not very fancy thing in a certain way. I mean, it may be fancier than I think, and I want to know. Because, I have these desires, and I'm disposed to act on them. But it's nice to reflect on them, because some of my desires are really yucky things, right? I'm walking by a window. I remember being a poor graduate student, walking by a window, seeing all those goods, and I had this desire to break that window and take all those goods, which I could not afford, but I really want it. But, you know, I was a reflective guy, and I stopped myself. I thought, gosh, would that really be a good thing to do? Do I really want to spend my life in jail? Do I really want to be embarrassed in front of all my friends? Do I really want to end my philosophical career? No. Okay. So that was a good thing. Okay. But isn't that just the capacity to weigh all the different things that, you know, push and pull me? I mean, that's not very fancy, is it? And why does that deserve the name autonomy? Because my reflection was determined by something or other about me and about my upbringing and education.
Well, we want to add a couple of conditions, and that is that the things that you were free from, the things you were guided by, are things that are okay for us to be guided by. It doesn't screw up our ability to reflect, and we are able to maintain our capacities in this way. But there are other things that if you found out later, the reason you didn't break that window was because someone slipped you a kind of conformity drug on the way to school that day, or because someone hypnotized you. You might think, oh, wait, was that really my decision? I think very differently now about that decision. So it is true that your values and desires and even your reflections will be moved by some things, like your education, but not things that we think disable you from being the kind of your own person and being a self-governing agent. And that's the distinction we want to hold on to, I think.
Yeah, Ken, let's go back a little further in your biography before you had all of these desires to break into shops and so forth. when you were at Notre Dame, you decided to be a philosopher. Now, from the outside, that looks like it must have been an autonomous decision. I know your parents weren't pushing
to
be a philosopher.
That's true.
And I doubt if the priests at Notre Dame were saying, why don't you be an analytic philosopher and argue the virtues of rationality and atheism for the rest of your life? But that's the kind of thing where we really value autonomy, choosing what role you're going to play in society. It seems to me worth singling out as one virtue among others.
I agree. It's worth singling out as one virtue among others. But then we go back to the caller's question of comparing Japan to the U.S. It's one virtue among others. But now how much does it weigh? In Western democracies, we seem to have put that like as the primary virtue, as the thing we value among highest among all, and the thing that kind of the very structure of our shared life has to respect that the most. Why?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that insofar as autonomy means nonconformity, it means not necessarily cooperating and bucking the trend, then it is only one, you know, parochial virtue among others, and sometimes not a very important one. But if it means something like just being an agent who is reflectively able to get behind our values, then I think it's something worth protecting in either very communitarian societies. And one thing I want to add, though, we as philosophers, we're always in our own head. So everything we're talking about are these internal reflections, as if, you know, we make these rational decisions. But we are in a social milieu, and we run into other people. And sometimes people ask us why we did something, and they hold us accountable. And we have to give them reasons, or at least, you know, considerations that bear in favor or against something. So that interpersonal dynamic actually makes our ability to reflectively either endorse, come up and support our decisions, or feel alienated from them. That's very important because that's presupposed in that conversation.
I understand. I think we've gotten to something deep because you said something in passing that I want to stress. It's as if you don't really have a self at all until you have an autonomous, self-governing self. To be a self at all is not just to be pushed and pulled by desire, but be able to stand back and reflect and choose, right? And once you're a self, then you notice that you're one self among other selves and that they have this same kind of capacity, and then you argue with one another and try to cooperate or don't. Do I have you right? Do you think that autonomy is the very part of being a self at all?
That's exactly right. I think that the self is what is produced, it's constructed, if we want to use that word, by this ability to interact with other people, but also give reasons and to be moved by important considerations and reject others. I think a mistake in some traditional theories of autonomy, based on its the root it comes from, is to think that there, inside us all, there already is a self. It's a core that we just have to find, and if that does the ruling, then we're being autonomous or self ruling. And I don't think that's right. It's not as if there is a core waiting to be found. The self is that which enacts these processes of reflective engagement and reflective.
So the feminist critique that says autonomy is an archaic virtue left over from the Wild West days of disconnected individuals, you have a response to that critique, because you can say autonomy, we kind of jointly constitute ourselves as autonomous being by being in relationship to one another. It's not something that presupposes we're outside all relations. Is that right?
Exactly. And in fact, I teach in women's studies, I think of myself as a feminist, and I would think that if our concept of autonomy would mean that relationships of care and mothering and other kinds of close, intimate relations, if those things are less valuable because we value autonomy, we've got the wrong concept. We shouldn't value it. So I think that taking up these situations where people are not trying to be independent, they're not trying to break away. I mean, imagine a person, if by autonomy we meant, oh, such as the mother who abandons her children to be more free and to take up a new career. That's not a value we want to promote.
John, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation. We're just getting to some really deep stuff, but it's radio, so we have to end it.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been John Crisman, professor of philosophy and political science at Penn State University, co-editor of Autonomy and the Challenges to Liberalism.
Oh, we want to thank the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to, the emailers we didn't get a chance to read their emails. We're glad to know there's interest out there, and we benefit from your participation.
So, John, what did you learn today?
Well,
self-governing guy that you are.
Yeah, I guess it's goodbye to Clint Eastwood autonomy and hello to feminist autonomy. That's a conception I didn't have very squarely in my mind, and it's worth thinking about. I do think there is a sense in which autonomy is a somewhat we might say, Western or even Lockean as opposed to Rousseauian virtue. It's not something that. And another thing we might think about is, when should you be autonomous? You might say, well, you should let society pick its role for you and do your best at it, and then when you retire, that's when you should be autonomous and take a look at the whole thing. That's attractive to me as I approach retirement.
There you go. I mean, there is something about the historical roots of our notions of autonomy and our belief that they should be the central notions in organizing shared life. I think, I'm no great historian of ideas, but I think it really just goes back not much further than the Enlightenment. I mean, it's the Enlightenment that put this at the center of thought about morality and political organization. And so, you know, and since we kind of post-Enlightenment figures, we kind of see to the Enlightenment it's truth, but you know, we maybe need to step outside that a little bit.
Well, I think people might think that American society in many ways is autonomy run amok. On the one hand, we want to we claim that freedom is really the primary virtue that should be guaranteed around the world, and yet at home we. Our idea of autonomy seems to me rebel against your parents and get a tattoo.
Very deep.
So there's more thinking to be done, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and we'll do that on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. And now we turn to a man struggling to assert his own philosophical autonomy, Ian Scholes, the so-called 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it has come to my attention that certain listeners to this program have been attending my commentaries with a stopwatch, and certain among them are dissatisfied with my being called 60-second philosopher, since few of these commentaries, well, none of them, actually, clock in at 60 seconds. Now, I cling to my autonomy as a miser does his gold, and yet I acknowledge the possibility of choice in this matter. I am a creature of free will, yes, but I only exist here at the whims of others. If you are not infotained by my fact-based pieces, I am nothing. And if you are distracted before I even begin by a misrepresentation of what you are about to hear, well, it could lead to confusion, chaos, the end of the world as we know it, unemployment. In my defense, I never believed that 60-second was intended as an accurate unit of measurement. It was offered in the same spirit as I would walk 500 miles, 1,000-yard stair, 20,000 leagues under the sea, 24-7, 60-minute man, and 99.5 won't do. In a larger sense, it's akin to a baker's dozen, hell's half acre, 90-11, 12-tee, a skosh, a smidgen, iota, scintilla, shred, tittle, and wit, morsel, crumb, tidbit, a tad, dollop, chicken feet, snippet. You're a subatomic philosopher, if you will, itty-bitty, just tiny. How much is a jillion? Nobody knows. How big is Google? Nobody knows. 60-second? Again, unknowable, really. Could be ginormous if you're waiting for a bus in the rain. Could be itsy-bitsy if you're taking a shower. Still, in the interest of compromise, here's my 2 cents. Actually, that would be a dime in today's economy. Here are some suggested alternatives. Feel free to send me, your erstwhile 60-second philosopher, your own. New York Minute philosopher, accelerated philosopher, impetuous philosopher, breakneck philosopher, headlong philosopher, snappy philosopher, double-time philosopher, quick-step philosopher, PDQ philosopher, blue-streak philosopher, hasty philosopher, brisk philosopher, and finally, get on board the Philosophy Express. In the interest of accuracy, we could call this particular segment the 2 minutes and 13 second philosopher. Even though I'm not really a philosopher, I just play one on the radio. But let's not go there. Full disclosure, my real number is 7, but I still gotta look out for number 1. As I've told you once, if I've told you 1,000 times, I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.